Day four at the 52nd New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our third period speaker is Brother Tecklin Morgan on Esther, an Unlikely Saviour. His subtitle for today is Esther's Courage. This is the third talk in his series. The introductory reading is Esther chapter 4. Please, Brother Tecklin.
Thanks, Alan. Good evening, everyone. We've come to a critical time, haven't we, in this narrative, because things are looking bad. The decree has gone forth, and the Jews everywhere are to be eliminated. We're talking genocide, and, well, something needs to be done, and we've just been reading of the record. Mordecai has done his bit. He's made a public display of his concern, and he sits there in sackcloth, now unable to come into the presence of the king. The Jews are mourning everywhere, and Esther is mighty concerned. And when at last she finds out exactly what it is and sees the nature of the decree, well, she's faced with the fundamental dilemma. And summed up in what perhaps is the most critical part of the entire narrative are those words: if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? That's the sort of expression that people can use for self-help books, isn't it? For such a time as this. Because, well, it challenges us. It challenges us to ask, what is our function in the purpose of God? For what have we been called? Here, Esther was clearly in a place of influence, a place of power, with a critical issue as far as the whole Jewish community was concerned. And how was she to respond to it? Well, she says, I'm a bit out of the king's favour, I think. We've been married 5 years. He hasn't called me for the last 30 days. Remember, he had a harem, so he had a range of people that he could have access to if he felt that way. And now she is saying, you know the laws of the Medes and Persians. If I go into his presence uninvited, and he doesn't like the look of me, then that's it. But if I perish, I perish. It takes real courage, doesn't it, in that situation, to face up to an issue as formidable as that with such a man. If he was a different sort of man, well, maybe you'd be able to chance it, but, well, we know the sort of man he was. He was a man of whim, of temper, of passion, and of great power. If he said off with her head, off her head went. There would be no doubting that. And if he chanced to fancy a new queen or another addition to his harem without the complications of having to pay for Esther, well, that could be done. And I wonder how you think about what the Persian court was like. No doubt it was grand. I mean, he was the most powerful and the wealthiest man in the world that then was. So he would have liked a bit of style about his appearance, no doubt. And there was the issue. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. You know, sometimes, because we like to make types and patterns out of things that aren't really types and patterns, but, well, we're ingenious, we like to make the suggestion that this is how we approach into the presence of Almighty God, and that Esther, perhaps, is like the bride of Christ, going into the presence of God, and Mordecai may be a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. You think Xerxes is fit to be a representative of Almighty God? And do you think that if we go uninvited into the divine presence, off with your head will be the answer of the creator of the universe? It just doesn't work, does it? And in fact, when we bring ourselves back to the history and the actual circumstance, we do Esther a huge favour. She was going then to put her life in her hand, and it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes. Literally, she put on royalty. Remember, for 3 days she had been fasting. No doubt she was in sackcloth, if at least it was covered by some outer garment. And now she puts on royalty and stands in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house. While the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. But it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favour in his sight. Wow, it's a relief. And the king held out to Esther the golden sceptre that was in his hand, and Esther went near and touched the top of the sceptre. I wonder when you're teaching this story in Sunday school, or when you're talking to children about it and perhaps using a Bible storybook, I wonder what sort of mental image you are conjuring up in their minds. Do you see her, for example, as this illustrator sees her, sliding up pretty close to the king, but hiding behind a curtain, and then no doubt going, hello, or maybe just a gentle wave? Do you see it like that? It might have been like that, mightn't it? Maybe she was able to get quite close, but not that close. Although, remember, Persian kings were mighty about their privacy and didn't like the prospect of people coming in uninvited. So maybe you see it in a different guise. All sorts of different illustrators have put it in a different way. And when at last Hollywood decided to make a film of it, well, you can imagine that they blew it up grand indeed. And that Esther was right at the back of a long hall. And the king sees her through the misty distance and wonders, he hadn't seen her, remember, for 30 days. Is that Queen Esther? And as she approached, well, she'd need to come up a grand staircase, wouldn't she? Frame by frame, you know, as she generally approaches. Until at last she comes into the king's presence. Well, we don't know, do we, exactly how it worked out, but it would have been grand and it would have been frightening for her. And remember, she's been fasting for 3 days, so she's not at her best. You can see just looking at me that I've never fasted for 3 days in all my life. But I try to be empathetic, and I can imagine sort of what it would be like. I'd be jolly hungry myself. And so she comes into the king's presence, and the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom." Well, I don't think he literally meant that, because he was a big kingdom and he was a bit short of funds at this particular time. He'd been fighting against Greece, remember, and he still had his army out in the field. But it was, you know, the way that royals speak. You might remember Herod made exactly the same statement when we lost John the Baptist. And this was Esther's reply. "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Just notice that little detail. Although she had been fasting, she had been preparing the banquet. So she had a plan in mind, this girl. She wasn't just wandering into his presence in the hope that some inspiration would dawn upon her. But she'd thought it out, she had a plan, and she was now seeking to execute it. And remarkably, in the very middle of those words, "Let the king and Haman come this day," is to be found the divine name. Well, the consonants of the divine name, YHWH, from which, of course, with the vowels added, we make Yahweh. It comes four times in the book, and we shall see three of those occasions within this little consideration today. So that the very words that she uses are themselves in some way able to include a cipher of the divine name. And so king and Haman come to the banquet. Well, I bet she was jolly glad of something to eat, if she was able to eat it, but what was she going to say? My petition and request is this, she says, in Esther chapter 5 and verse 7. If I have found favour in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. Well, of course, it has to be said that that is a remarkable way of building up some tension in the narrative, isn't it? If indeed that's what the spirit is thinking. The spirit is thinking, let's delay this by a day. But I wonder why she didn't spring the question there and then. And I can think of one or two reasons. For a start, she hadn't eaten for 3 days, so she's probably not at her best. Secondly, the king was probably drunk. You know, the Persians had a way of doing business, and the way to do business was to get intoxicated, and then they would take a decision. And then they wouldn't act upon that decision until in the morning when they were sober. They would reconsider the decision, and then if they still thought it made sense, the decision they had made when they were drunk, but now they were sober, then they would go forward with that particular decision. I mean, it's not quite the way we do things in Britain, but looking at you, I don't think it's the way you do it in New Zealand either. At least, not those of us who are present here. But that's how the Persians went. So she may well have used female intuition and thought, this is not a good time. He's not in a good mood. I think he's probably had a few too many drinks anyway, and maybe we'll leave it until tomorrow. Or maybe it was that providentially she thought, we ought to delay this just a day, because as it turns out, that turns out to be a very, very good strategy, although she couldn't have known the full significance of that at the time. Well, just imagine what it was like to go back with Haman to his house that very night and to hear him talk around the supper table about the great things that have happened. He rehearses to them what a wealthy man he is, and how many children he has. Well, they were his family, so they had a pretty good idea of how many children he had, and the fact that he was a very wealthy man. After all, they were faring fairly sumptuously, no doubt. But you know, a man who is so egotistic just can't avoid that chat in that particular way. And then, of course, he adds the critical detail. Guess who was invited to dine with the king and the queen? Just me. And by the way, guess who's been invited to go again tomorrow? It's me. And so he was full of that very possibility. And well, you could see the ego had landed in that particular sense, but there was a fly in the ointment. Just as he thought about it, he thought, you know, there's only one thing that is really spoiling my complete appreciation. And that one thing is Mordecai. That man, do you know, even as I was leaving the palace today and he was there outside, clothed in some rubbish or other, he would not bow down before me. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. And look what Zeresh says. Let a gallows be made. Incidentally, this is the wife who is giving that advice. It's the female tense that governs this particular expression. Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now, whether there's a measure of exaggeration to make the point here is difficult to say, but that was an enormously high gallows. It's the equivalent of an 8-story building. It's about 20 metres high, the length of a cricket pitch, for those of you who are still watching the score in the fifth test, which I dread to think about. Maybe it was, however, that it was the branch of a tree. And maybe, in fact, there was a tall tree outside, and the arrangement was that they could rig up a pulley and they could have hauled him up to that particular height. It's difficult to know exactly how this was going to work, but those of you who are engineers, well, you'll have to put your mind to whether you could build something 20 metres high which was merely going to act as a gallows without some sort of supplementary support. Well, he thought that was an excellent idea, and incidentally, in chapter 5 and verse 13... Not in chapter 5 and verse 13, but in the passage that I was just quoting in, chapter 5 and verse 13. Let all this avail me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. The words, this availeth me nothing, spoken by Haman, remember, remarkably contain the initials of the divine name, this time backwards. Someone kindly came up to me after I'd shown the first one and said, you've got a typo on that, you had all the letters backwards. But curiously enough, sometimes the divine name is backwards, then forwards, then backwards. That's the pattern that we've seen so far. So this is YHWH backwards. Remarkable though, isn't it, that these are the words of Haman. And yet as Haman utters those words, this availeth me nothing, the divine name is to be found included in them. And if you're just wondering how that works as far as the Hebrew text is concerned, then what it means is that those four words are each led by a letter which spells out, in this instance, YHWH. So the word is led by the first letter. And as I said before, if you recall, the Jews, aware of that, actually enlarged the first letter, so that it stood out in the Hebrew text. And yet these are the words of Haman, and this is Haman's device. Yet availeth me nothing, yet it avails me nothing. And there we are to see a man who is planning an act which will lead eventually to his own undoing. It's the psalmist who says, behold, the wicked brings forth iniquity. Yes, he conceives trouble and brings forth falsehood. He made a pit and dug it out, and has fallen into the ditch which he made. His trouble shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down on his own crown. Nevertheless, he must have been a very satisfied man, for all that we know, that this was destined for his own destruction. He must have been very pleased when he saw the gallows being erected and when he thought to himself, I can't wait for the moment when I can pop into the palace and get this done. And then my satisfaction will be complete. And what of Esther as she prepared the next banquet? Did you notice she had prepared the first, but she said, I will prepare another meal. So no doubt she was busy back in the palace, and no doubt she was making the preparations that would be necessary for when Haman and the king came the second time. And outside the walls, if she could hear anything from within her closeted environment, there were the Jews still wailing and lamenting. And Mordecai, I remember, still in his sackcloth, still as erect and unbowing as he had ever been. And far away, the Jews in Jerusalem, still bemoaning their fate and watching the calendar gradually slipping down until the day when they would be destroyed and the temple would be cast down. It's a real issue for Esther, isn't it? You wonder whether she had a sleepless night herself, whether she was tossing and turning and wondering and worrying and just trying to get into her mind exactly how she could best put the issue, when at last the queen spoke and showed the king exactly what it was that she wanted. And the king? Well, that night the king couldn't sleep himself. It might have been that he had said to the queen, you can have whatever you want up to half of my kingdom. And maybe he was wondering, which half is she likely to ask for? Or maybe it was just one of those things. He'd eaten and drunk too much and there was no medication that was immediately handy. And if he could only have switched on the internet and could have sought for some ideas about sleep hygiene, then he would have thought, it's a bit hot in here. I must cool down a little. I must work out some sort of schedule here. You know, all the sort of self-help things that exist today. But he had a plan of his own. I mean, you have to wonder. I mean, he had a lot of women who could have come and have entertained him, but obviously he thought there was a better ruse. And the better ruse was, I know, I'll have somebody come and read me the chronicles of the kings of Persia. After all, you know, we speakers, we notice quite often that if we speak in a nice lulling sort of way, you slip away quite merrily without any real difficulty, whether you're tired or not. And so in that instance, maybe he thought exactly the same thing, that if somebody came and read him the chronicles of the kings of Persia, that, well, he'd slip away while they were in the middle of it. So they brought the book of the records of the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, "What honour or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." See, ordinarily within the chronicles, what had been done to honour and reward someone who had done a great personal service for the king would have been recorded in the chronicles. And the absence of such a record, and this might have happened as long ago as 4 years or so, maybe as much as 5 years ago. Remember, the king had been married to Esther for 5 years. Mordecai had been in the gate when this happened. Remember, when the virgins were assembled, I suggested perhaps those virgins who had not been into the king were being assembled to be sent home in their perfumed splendour. And perhaps it was that a long period had taken place, and that now the king was thinking, this doesn't look good. Because, well, protocol requires that something should be done. And, you know, he was a man who could never make a decision by himself, and so he says, "Is there anybody around who could give me some advice about all of this?" This is the leader of the then enslaved world, remember, the Persian Empire. And who should be there but another man who couldn't sleep? A man who was really, really anxious at the crack of dawn to come and make sure that Mordecai was dangling on the end of the rope. After all, he got the gallows finished now and he wanted to complete the business. And you notice the danger here. Esther has a plan. We're not entirely sure what that plan is yet, but perhaps she's still working it out herself as to exactly how she's going to spring the issue to the king and what precisely she's going to ask. But it could well have been that Mordecai had been hanged before the second banquet took place. So here's the divine intervention to rescue that man. And the king says, "I need a bit of help with this because it's a breach in protocol. Is there anybody hanging around that could help me?" And somebody says, "Ha, you're second in command. Haman has just come into the court." So the king said, who is in the court, and Haman had just entered. He'd come to ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said to him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." Well, it's delicious, the irony of this particular situation, isn't it? I mean, we all rejoice in the way that the tables are about to be turned here. Haman came in and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honour?" And Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honour more than me?" And now you get an insight into Haman's thinking and Haman's preferences. Remember, he had 10 sons. He was an extremely wealthy man from all accounts. So he's hardly likely to be asking for money or for land. But wouldn't he like to be the king? And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honour, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden. It was, incidentally, a capital offence for anyone but the king to sit on one of the king's special horses, which has a royal crest placed on its head. That would be on the saddle, I think, rather than the actual head of the horse. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honour. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. Well, just feel for a moment the full satisfaction as Haman sees himself in his own mind's eye being led by some of the nobles who proclaim what a fine and wonderful man he is. And there's a statement that catches that situation perfectly. For 'tis the sport to have the engineer hoist with his own petard. Does anybody know where that expression comes from? I'll give you a clue. Sorry? It is indeed William Shakespeare. Do you know where in William Shakespeare? It's Hamlet, which he wrote in 1602. And here's the crunch. Do you know what a petard is? Yeah, well, not quite under the wall, but against the gate. That's entirely right. It's the engineer who comes to break the gate down, and the petard is his little explosive device, which is going to burst the gate open. And what Shakespeare says, it's great fun, where it backfires, and the engineer himself is destroyed, and the gate remains intact. So you can see Shakespeare had a sense of humour as well. And that's exactly what was to happen to Haman now, because what ends up happening is that Haman now has to change Mordecai's attire, take off his sackcloth and put on the king's royal robe, get out the horse, have Mordecai mount the horse, and he himself walks through the streets of Persia saying, thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delights to honour. Except that I don't think he said that at all. I think he said, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. In other words, speaking through gritted teeth, because this was Mordecai, his very enemy. This was the man who would not bow down before him. And so everything had gone badly wrong. And when he goes home, well, the middle of the morning, I suppose, and then confers with his family, they have a rather different take on the night before. Remember the night before, everything was going to be fine. His wife had said, build a gallows and string that man up on it. But now they say, when he goes back, mourning and with his head covered, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. And on that very moment then, the eunuchs come saying, hey, you're late for the banquet. It's time for you to come with us. And do you notice how control has shifted here? Where before he had been the master of his own destiny, now suddenly he is being taken to the banquet. He's lost control of the situation and things are slipping downhill. But pause and think for a moment of how Esther would have felt on the eve of the second banquet. I'm not sure that she would have been able to see out of the palace. That would probably have been too unbecoming, because if she could see out of the palace, people could see her from outside the palace, so that probably didn't work. But quite clearly, the courtiers would have, well, they would have rejoiced in the fact that Haman had his comeuppance, and that Mordecai, whom they seemed quite well acquainted with and friendly towards, had in fact now suddenly triumphed over a man they didn't like very much. So when the message came to her that things have gone remarkably well for your stepfather, and as such then, or your foster father, and as such, everything seems to be working out well, you can just imagine that when at last Haman came, probably a little less prepared than he would have hoped to have been, but no doubt he had a quick splash in the refreshment area of the palace before at last he came into the king's presence. Now it was at the second day, at the banquet of wine, that the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request?" He's crossing his fingers as he says this bit. "Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done." I mean, that was just royal protocol, and surely, for goodness sake, she wouldn't ask for anything as substantial as that. And the queen answered and said, "If I have found favour in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request." Well, it's wonderfully put, isn't it? Beautifully put. And you be Xerxes for a moment, and you see this beautiful woman sitting there and asking, "Could I have my life, please, and the life of my people? If it had only been slavery, we would have put up with that. But genocide is just a step too far." And Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? And where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen, and the king was in a state of absolute confusion. There was nobody there who could advise him. So now what's he going to do? He goes out for a walk in the garden, just to try and clear his head. Who knows? There might be one of his other officials in the garden to whom he could consult. The king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. One of the Talmudic commentaries on this instance suggests that he had been coming there to petition for his life for the queen, and an angel pushed him so that he fell upon the couch. And the king, returning from the garden, said, "Will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. You know, there's an irony, if you like. He is now being accused of rape, which of course he would have certainly not been contemplating in the circumstances. He was in dire trouble as it was. But he is going to be executed for rape, whereas in fact his crime was genocide. And he never committed the rape, but he did commit the attempted genocide, and now he is executed for something he never did at all. That's just how the whole situation is working out. And those very words, "he saw that evil was determined against him by the king," is the fourth occurrence where the divine name appears concealed within the narrative. It's a remarkable thing, isn't it, that there is Almighty God working behind the scenes in the most remarkable way. And Harbona said to the king, well, the king needed a bit of advice, so one of the seven eunuchs who had been there in chapter 1 says, "Look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." It must have been a pretty tall structure. They had clearly seen it from the palace, and they'd been able to say, "There's a gallows out there. I wonder who he's thinking of." "Mordecai, probably," the other courtiers would have said. Well, the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath subsided. So we've been tracking through then those occurrences, those remarkable occurrences, where the divine name is to be found concealed within the text. "All the wives shall give," Memucan had said, and backwards had come those four letters, YHWH, the consonants, remember, that with the vowels make up Yahweh, the memorial name. Then in chapter 5 and verse 4, "Let the king and Haman come this day," spoken by Esther once again, the name was to be found concealed. Chapter 5 and verse 13, this time it's Haman speaking to his family. This availeth me nothing. Again, it's backwards there. And finally, the narrator in chapter 7 and verse 7, there was evil determined against him. And this time it's forward. And incidentally, there in chapter 7 and verse 5, where the king speaks, who is he and where is he? The divine name, I've forgotten what it is for the moment. I am that I am, is Eir Asher Eir, or I will be that I will be. And there in that very expression is the name of God again to be found five times then, where those are to be found concealed within the text. If you want to read a bit more about that and have got access to Bullinger's Companion Bible, then it's in Appendix 60. It has to be said that there are a lot of commentators and critics who say that this is Jewish fancy, and it's a little bit like Drosnin's attempt to find Bible codes by scanning the text in a desperate attempt to try and find something there. But Roy Standeven, and we sang one of his hymns earlier today, has written a nice little book on the fascination of Esther, in which he picks up the details from Bullinger's Companion Bible. So why then are those names hidden in the text? Why don't they become quite clear? Why is God not obviously seen in these dealings, but is only seen concealed? Well, there are some powerful reasons why God might not have chosen to have placed his name into this very text. These were people who could have returned and who could have gone back to Jerusalem, who could be involved in the work of the temple and the work of reconstructing the nation. There was a time back in Isaiah when the godless nation was told, when you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. And later on, Isaiah would say, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait on the Lord who hides his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. And Moses had said much earlier than Isaiah, behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land where they go to be among them, and they will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. You see, maybe the fact that the divine name does not appear on the face of the record is an indication that God had raised up Mordecai and Esther to save the godly remnant that were in Jerusalem, and that they were being used as part of the divine purpose, but were not in fellowship with God himself. Remember, I pointed out the problem that Esther would have had concealing her identity in a palace that was dominated by Zoroastrian religion, where she could hardly have kept herself as a faithful Jew, a Jewess. So maybe what we're seeing there is that God was at work behind the scenes, remarkably bringing things to their culmination and fulfillment, but these were not really people who were walking with him, believing in him, trusting in his salvation. So what have we learned then as we've looked at this situation? Well, when God's people are in trouble, and remember this was genocide that was going to eradicate the Jewish nation from the entirety of the Persian Empire, including Jerusalem, when God's people are in trouble, God has an answer. And he doesn't always work in the way that we might expect. After all, he could simply have withdrawn Haman's breath. Haman could just have died one night quietly in his sleep before he had even got round to plotting and planning such devastation. But Esther did her part when it was expected of her, And we have the same opportunity from time to time. And when those opportunities come, we have to do our part. We have to do what we think is right in whatever circumstances come our way. And sometimes that can take real courage. Esther had to be courageous, there's no doubt about it. Whatever we think about her personally, she was a courageous woman to have done what she did. And a clever woman too, in the way that she assessed the king and the suitability of that occasion and had a fallback plan and made arrangements until the time was right and posed the question when she knew it was right. And look what a contrast there is between Xerxes and the inability that people had to go into his presence. I haven't seen him for 30 days, she said, and I can't just wander in, you know, I might get killed. And the fact that any time, any place, we can go into the presence of the King of Kings and make our petitions to him in the sure and certain knowledge that he cares for us and listens to all we have to ask. And God has wonderful ways of answering our prayers, just as remarkably he answered the needs of the Jewish people and doubtless the prayers that would have been offered in Jerusalem. If Esther and Mordecai were not praying, and we don't know for sure that they weren't praying, but the record does not record that they were, then certainly in Jerusalem they would have been praying hard. And if we are alert to events, we can be much encouraged, just as Esther would have been when she had heard what had happened to Mordecai and would have thought, hey, the tide is turning in our favour. It looks as though the portents are good. It looks as though tomorrow could be a happy day. And we might sometimes, like Esther, have to bide our time. Not rush in, but wait until the opportunity is appropriate to do what we are asked to do. But if we wait on God, then we can be assured that all will turn out well. Mark, remember that remarkable verse in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. All things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. We can take real comfort and consolation in that.